Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And unfortunately, we've got to start the pod off in kind of a downer note. I have been personally sanctioned by the Russian government. A list was released today that sanctions me and a number of other people, including Larry Summers, some fellow professors and scholars. And so I just want to take this time to apologize to Russia and say, I'm very sorry if my takes were too hot or if I offended you, but please don't sanction me. So that's just how I wanted to start the news. But Derek, I was wondering if you had any.
I'd like to issue my own statement to the Russian government. Please get this guy. He has been running amok for years now.
Far too long.
Nobody has stepped up to counter him. You go further. I mean, this is a good start. I'm not criticizing what you've done so far, but there's more room to squeeze this man. And you know, get on him. Just go for it. I mean, seriously, somebody's got to do something.
I mean, everyone. Derek informed me that now I can't get any of my assets that are in Russia. But just last month, he told me to convert all of my savings into rubles. So I think he might have known something about this, to be honest.
I can't confirm or deny any foreknowledge of this.
Well, Derek, let's stay in Russia, and why don't we talk about the Russian election, which is starting?
Yeah, I thought it would be appropriate to begin here under the circumstances. Russian voters are going to start heading to the polls on Friday for 3 days of voting in a presidential election that, you know, I sort of don't even know why we're bothering. Vladimir Putin is going to win, of course, because that's just how it goes.
With members of Russia's fragile opposition dead, jailed, or sent into exile, Vladimir Putin keeps a firm grip on its political system. His three opponents on the ballot stand no chance.
Even if, you know, these were free, quote-unquote free elections, where the votes actually count and it's all done in an up-and-up way, there's nobody running against him of any note. So, I mean, you know, he's virtually uncontested. I think there are a couple of minor other candidates on the ballot, but nobody of any prominence. And so, you know, best of luck to him, I guess. Certainly, I support his anti-Bessner policy, but, you know, I don't...
Derek has never supported Putin until now.
I don't see any reason to be worried that he might not eke out a win here. It's always funny to me when when elections come around in countries like this, where there's an interest in the West in sort of stressing that these are not legitimate, this is not a legitimate democratic process, it's all, you know, rigged behind the scenes or whatever. But the desire, it seems like, to just reflexively pretend that any election is a big deal, whether that's a media thing or an institutional thing, I don't know, but the reporting on these things still like treats it like a horse race. It's still like, you know, Vladimir Putin is, you know, asking voters to come to the polls and vote for him. Or, you know, in this case, and we'll get into this a little bit later, there's been a flurry of recent attacks by the Ukrainian military against some Russian facilities or a cross-border attacks. And it's couched in this, like, putting pressure on Vladimir Putin as Russians go to the polls. Like, this, it doesn't matter. It's all preordained, but I feel like you have to keep up this fiction that it's an election, so it's a contest.
Yeah, and I imagine everyone's united on an anti-Bessner policy. All right, Derek.
Well, I mean, I think he's definitely boosted his poll numbers with this. I will say that.
Yeah,
I
don't, through the roof.
I don't think there's any question about that. This is good politics domestically.
Well, gang, unfortunately, we've got to turn to an incredibly depressing topic, but we must keep you informed. And of course, that is Gaza. Derek, why don't we start with you giving us a humanitarian update?
So there's been some dancing around the edges of the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza recently, and not necessarily in bad ways, although nothing has been done so far to obviously to meet the need that has been created by the Israeli military campaign and the devastation that it's caused. That said, there's some indications that maybe the Israeli government is starting to feel some pressure to do more. Maybe that's coming from the Biden administration. I don't know. The Biden administration continues to do this bizarre tango to try and get around a blockade that, or an effective blockade that it is also supporting and enabling, which makes no sense. But as I say, there have been a few developments here. Everybody knows that the airdrop started a few weeks ago. That's, you know, been widely ridiculed, I think justly, because it doesn't even qualify as a drop in the bucket. There's no way you can actually address the need through airdrops. But the maritime effort to get shipments of aid in from Cyprus to Gaza is continuing to develop along a couple of different lines. There is a charity operation from Europe, a European NGO, that is already has already sent a ship to Gaza from Cyprus. It is, I don't know when it was supposed to arrive, I think on Thursday. I haven't heard that whether it has arrived off the Gazan coast or not. I have no idea what the plan is. Supposedly there are people in Gaza working for the NGO who are building some kind of makeshift pier or jetty system to offload the cargo. They haven't talked very much about the details here about how this would actually take place. And then even if that is built, what would happen once the cargo is offloaded, because there's no security in place. There's no obvious distribution system in place. Gaza is a war zone. There's a lot of logistical questions about this. The second operation that's going on that maybe is potentially more substantive is this U.S. military operation to build. And you know, there's a piece in the BBC earlier this week that tried to unpack what exactly is going to happen here, you know, based on, you know, the usual anonymous reporting from U.S. Sources, whatever. But the idea is to build, again, an offshore pier and some kind of a causeway system. So the pier would be offshore. The causeway would be built offshore and then would be carted onshore somehow. And the operation would be to unload these big cargo ships of aid that would presumably come from Cyprus. The U.S. is working with a logistics advisory firm that just so happens to be staffed with a bunch of U.S. officials or ex-U.S. military officials. Nothing to see there, I'm sure. They're trying to raise money from governments, from private donors to support basically commercial shipments of food that would come in. The cargo ships would be offloaded on this offshore pier system, and then they would be taken by smaller boats to the causeway. That is still proceeding. The U.S. military dispatched a logistics support vessel to Gaza. It's, you know, got to come from the U.S., so it's going to take a few days to get there. But they dispatched one earlier this week to facilitate the construction of this pier. Everything else about this plan, again, is like a black hole. Basically, it's unclear how they would secure the facility. The piece I read said that the IDF would be responsible for securing the pier, which seems like a bad idea to me, but what do I know? And it's unclear how the aid would be distributed. And I think basically from the U.S. perspective, from the Biden administration's perspective, this is like, we're setting up this pier and then we're going to, you know, dust our hands off and say our work here is done and check out in hopes that that will be enough, I think, for a domestic audience. I don't see any real concern to make sure that this aid gets to anybody who needs it. The other piece that took place this week that is potentially more promising, I think, than the maritime stuff is that the Israeli military opened a new checkpoint potentially to bring aid in directly to northern Gaza, where there are, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, 200,000, 300,000 people who are trapped, still trapped by the war or the conflict, are starving, you know, in many cases, even worse shape than the people in southern Gaza. The minimal efforts to bring food aid to northern Gaza via the two checkpoints that are open in southern Gaza have been a complete bust. It's just logistically impossible. It doesn't happen frequently enough. And so there was a report a couple of days ago that the Israelis had opened a checkpoint directly into northern Gaza. I don't know where exactly the checkpoint is located. It's not the Erez crossing, which is in peacetime the main crossing between Israel and northern Gaza, but it does feed directly into. Now, they brought in a very small shipment. It was enough food, I think they said, for 25,000 people, so hardly anything, but as a test case, potentially this could lead to more shipments and larger ones. All of this is, like, you know, I'll believe it when I see it, but it at least offers some promise. Now, I think that land route into northern Gaza is the most significant, because people are dying right now. People are starving to death right now. So building a pier, which is going to take a couple of months, you know, whatever this charity thing is, you know, whatever's happening with this charity thing, all the logistical problems that this maritime operation entails, that can't be worked out in time to save people who are starving to death right now. So I think the land checkpoint is potentially promising, but we'll have to see if it really turns into a major effort.
Thanks, Derek. Why don't we talk about the Rafah operation and Biden's quote-unquote red line?
Yeah, so, you know, people are familiar. The Israeli military has been, the Israeli government, Benjamin Netanyahu, have been talking for weeks now about the inevitability of a full-scale assault on Rafah, which is the city in far southern Gaza along the Egyptian border. The Biden administration has been urging, I guess you could say, the Israelis not to go forward with a Rafah operation without what they could call a credible plan, an credible, actionable plan to get civilians out of there beforehand. Joe Biden gave an interview to MSNBC over the weekend. It was a confusing, rambling interview in which he at alternate times suggested that an Israeli assault on Rafah is a red line for him, and then said, no, it's not a red line. There's no red line. I think what he was trying to say was that it might be a red line in terms of weapons supplies or weapon shipments to Israel for offensive purposes, but there's no red line for, let's say, you know, resupplying ammunition for the Iron Dome or for, you know, Israeli defensive systems.
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have, but there's red lines that if it crosses, and you cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead.
Regardless, his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, in the, you know, subsequent couple of days, completely walked back the whole interview and said there's no red line on anything. We would never dream of, you know, questioning or threatening Israeli military supplies under any circumstance. Nevertheless, this talk of red line has been in the air. There have been a few times where the administration has thrown out these trial balloons of, like, we don't think the Israelis should do this. We want, you know, this is going to affect the relationship. This is going to affect weapon supplies. In every one of those cases, Benjamin Netanyahu has, and he's done it here too, basically told Joe Biden to cram his red line up his ass, and he's going to do what he wants. Israel's going to do what they want. He's done it again here. What's new, I guess, is there was a report in Politico on Wednesday saying that the Biden administration has privately explained to Israeli officials what kind of operation they would be willing to countenance in Rafah. And basically, it would be a counterterrorism operation rather than an all-out ground assault. So it would be targeted killing of Hamas officials or Hamas fighters, but not the indiscriminate violence that we've seen from this campaign so far. The political piece also suggested that whatever the Israelis are planning to do, they're not making any obvious overt preparation for it yet. So it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. What we also got this week was a claim from the spokesperson for the IDF, Daniel Hagari, saying that there's now, they have some nebulous plan to evacuate civilians from Rafah to central Gaza, where they're setting up, I believe he called it humanitarian islands. These would be facilities where, you know, not only would they evacuate people to them, but they would be set up to provide shelter, provide food, provide, you know, medical services, basic needs. I have no idea how they expect to carry that off, or whether they even do, or this is just, you know, rhetoric that's supposed to get everybody off their backs. I suspect more that than an actual plan. But that's also something that they talked about this week. Again, maybe reflecting that some of the pressure that's been mounting here is started to get to them.
Let's talk about Lebanon. And there have been more Israeli strikes on Lebanon. So, Derek, what's been going on?
There have been a number of Israeli strikes this week that have, killed civilians in at least a few cases. They're up. We're getting to close to 60 civilians that the IDF has killed in Lebanon since October 7th. The big events that are of concern from an escalatory standpoint are the IDF carried out two more bombing campaigns, you know, multiple airstrikes each time in the Bekaa Valley, which is in eastern Lebanon, far north of the border region where this, you know, conflict between the Israelis and Hezbollah, to a certain degree, the Hamas units that are active in Lebanon, has been taking place. They hit the city of Baalbek, which is the main population center in the Bekaa Valley. They've hit in the vicinity of Baalbek and a couple of other spots in the Bekaa Valley. And the reason that this is of a concern is because Hezbollah has repeatedly suggested that it's comfortable doing this sort of low level tit for tat violence as long as it remains confined to that southern Lebanon border region. And so every time the IDF carries out an attack north of that, and they've hit, you know, southern Beirut on at least one occasion, they've now hit, I think, on three occasions at least, they've conducted strikes in and around Baalbek and the Bekaa Valley. Every time this happens, there's fear that they're crossing a Hezbollah red line, and this could spark wider escalation. That hasn't happened so far. But it remains a concern.
Thanks, Derek. So it looks like the U.S. policy toward North Korea might be shifting. What is your hot take?
Yeah, so this is based on an interview that the Wall Street Journal did with the U.S. general who commands U.S. forces in South Korea, Paul LaCamera. And basically, he said he laid out, and this is very rare that a U.S. general in that position would give an interview to a media outlet, but he basically laid out a deterrence policy. He said, you know, we have to get, you know, we're get away from this idea that we're going to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, and instead we have to deter the North Koreans from using their nuclear weapons. We have to, as he put it, we have to assure Kim Jong-un that positive will be met with positive actions, is this quote, and negative will be met with negative, which is, you know, standard deterrence policy. But Danny, as you know, for the U.S. policy toward regarding the North Korean nuclear program is still officially denuclearization. It's the idea that you're somehow going to convince the North Korean government to give up its nukes. There is no reality-based scenario in which North Korea is likely to give up its nukes, except on a very long-term horizon, and only with disarmament, you know, more broadly, you know, under a more broad, you know, like broader disarmament arrangement. They have shown no inclination toward giving up their nukes, and so for a long time, people who kind of observe U.S. policy toward North Korea have been, many of them have been arguing that it needs to change. Get off of this unrealistic goal of denuclearization and adopt something much more realistic in the form of deterrence. So I think this was an interesting interview from that perspective, and you may suggest that there's some deeper things going on within the U.S. government.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about what everyone's been asking me about, which is, where is Kate Middleton?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm pretty sure that she was the agent who identified you and all the others for the Russian government who need to be sanctioned. And she's now gone home to, she's been deactivated and brought back.
That's a scoop. Kate Middleton has been deactivated.
Yeah.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at americanprestigepod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Let's talk about Sudan, where the military has made some gains in Omdurman.
Yeah, this is interesting. We've talked about the Rapid Support Forces group making these massive territorial gains all over Sudan as the military has struggled to keep up, especially on the ground. The military has certain advantages in terms of, or had them at least when their war started, in terms of air power, in terms of armor. The RSF, with the help of some of its friendly friends like the UAE, has developed drone capabilities and other things to try to counter those advantages. But more to the point, the RSF personnel are more battle hardened. They're more experienced. They're more seasoned. So they've been dealing the Sudanese military defeats in Darfur. They've taken over pretty much the entire Darfur region. They dealt most recently a few months ago a major defeat to the Sudanese military in Wad Madani, which positioned them, you know, kind of in the heart of the country. And they've been on the offensive in the capital region, which includes Khartoum. It includes Bahri or Khartoum North, and it includes Omdurman. They're all located at the confluence of the various Nile rivers, the Nile River origin. And so, you know, this is interesting. In the last couple of weeks, maybe month, the Sudanese military has apparently been making some gains in Omdurman specifically. And earlier this week, they managed to take back control of Sudan's national broadcasting company headquarters from the RSF. This includes the country's radio, the radio and television broadcast facilities. There's some indication that the Ukrainian military is admitting now that it has sent special forces to Sudan, thinking, I guess, that they're going to counter Russian involvement with the RSF. And maybe this is, you know, some way to kind of widen the war in Ukraine to a more global footprint, and they can cause Russia difficulty in some of these other places around the world. But they have apparently been of use to the Sudanese military, specifically in Omdurman. There have been some tactical things that the Sudanese military has taken from them, from these Ukrainian special forces that they have put to use, and apparently has been successful against the RSF. So this is an interesting development. As I say, it kind of reverses what has been the trend of this war, which has been the RSF on the move the entire time. I wouldn't say it's a significant development as the RSF's, you know, seizure of Wad Madani or its successes in Darfur, but it is an indication that the military may be improving its performance on the battlefield. Now, I will say there was a big push prior to the start of Ramadan, which was earlier this week, to get a ceasefire in place for the month, and the RSF expressed support for that ceasefire. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire late last week on Friday. The Sudanese military rejected it, or rather they put qualifications on any potential ceasefire. Specifically, they demanded that the RSF withdraw from civilian areas that it's captured over the course of the conflict. And of course, that's not going to happen. The RSF is not going to do that. So they effectively rejected the ceasefire. But I think there are still some negotiations going on, as there are for Gaza, we should say, in hopes of getting a ceasefire. If not, you know, now that the beginning of Ramadan is no longer an option, maybe by the end of the month, getting some kind of ceasefire in place. But, you know, in neither place is that. Does that effort look particularly promising?
Derek, let's move on to the topic that has made me lose my rubles, and that is Ukraine.
So there've been a few developments in Ukraine. Russian forces seized another village in the in Donetsk Oblast. They've been, you know, advancing in Donetsk since capturing the town of Avdiivka last month. They have been on a steady movement. Their advances seem to be slowing down, but just this week they did claim to have captured another village. So clearly there's still some movement happening there. Of more noteworthy, I guess, maybe than that, has been the Ukrainian military, as I mentioned earlier, has carried out several drone strikes this week against oil facilities in Russia. They carried out one in Nizhny Novgorod Oblast, another one in Oryol Oblast, another one. They hit the Rosneft, which is the, you know, one of the big Russian energy giants, hit its largest oil refinery in Ryazan province. There's another one in Rostov Oblast that they hit. So it's a trend, clearly. And it seems like what the Ukrainians are trying to do here, you know, they're unable to sort of counter the Russians on the front line in Ukraine or to drive them back, certainly. I guess the hope is that they can target these logistical facilities in an asymmetric way and maybe take some of them offline in hopes that that will impact the Russian military's ability to continue to maneuver in Ukraine. I mean, if you take down oil refineries, then, you know, they can't supply fuel for the tanks, for the, you know, the other Russian vehicles. Maybe that interrupts Russian operations somehow. It's a long shot, but I think this is where the Ukrainians are without, you know, with aid from the U.S. stalled effectively, although there was a little bit of movement on that we can talk about. But, you know, with the current situation in Ukraine, they're kind of reduced to taking these shots in the dark at Russian facilities in the hopes that it will have knock on effects on the Russian military.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the U.S. aid package.
On Tuesday, the Biden administration announced a new $300 million aid package for Ukraine, primarily, I think, artillery, ammunition, and other ammunition for things like anti-aircraft systems, rocket launchers, and that sort of thing, munitions rather than new, you know, kind of arms, armament systems.
Is this latest package that the president just announced essentially a stopgap measure?
Wolf, it can hardly even be called that. The White House made clear that this $300 million package could last a matter of weeks, perhaps as little as a couple of weeks.
This is, you know, obviously it's been a while since the Biden administration provided any new arms package to Ukraine, and they're still handcuffed to some degree by the fact that Joe Biden's big war supplemental funding bill is stuck in the U.S. House of Representatives. What they've done here is they're drawing down on existing U.S. weapons stockpiles without funding allocated to replenish those stockpiles. So this is something they can do. They can send the weapons, but they can't then replace them in for the U.S. military. And I think it's a political tactic. What they are hoping to do, I suspect, is to change the tone of the discussion around this bill from "we need this money to help Ukraine" to "we need this money to, you know, backfill these weapons." You're depriving, you Republicans are, you know, you vile Republicans are depriving the U.S. military of desperately needed mortar shells and the like, in hopes that will kind of ratchet up the pressure on Republicans to allow the funding bill to come to the floor, where I suspect it would pass. This is a leadership thing. This is Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, basically preventing the bill from coming to a vote. I suspect it would pass if it did come to a vote. There's also an effort, or a couple of different efforts, actually, we found out this week, to invoke what's called a discharge petition, which is a way to force a floor vote on a particular bill, even if the speaker doesn't want one to happen. That requires the support of an absolute majority of House representatives. So it's rarely invoked, and even more rarely are these efforts successful. In this case, who knows? As I say, I do think there's probably majority support in the House to pass this bill, but whether there's majority support to go around the speaker and embarrass him in that way, I don't know.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the Portugal election results. You know, Derek, I've been to Portugal. I really quite enjoyed it.
Well, hopefully they don't put you on a blacklist there, just, too.
Every country although, I'm just gonna
if anybody from the Portuguese government is listening, this is another. You could take him out. You could go hard. Go
Derek,
all
you're
going to
get me banned from every fucking country. Stop it.
Portugal had its parliamentary election on Sunday. The expectation was that the far right would do quite well, and that proved to be the case. The Chega party, which is the far right party in Portugal, finished third in the election. It won, I think the last estimate I saw was 46 seats. The Portuguese parliament is 230 seats in total. The two mainstream parties, the ruling center-left socialists and the center-right Democratic Alliance, finished in a virtual dead heat at around 28-29% of the vote. The Democratic Alliance has a couple of smaller coalition parties. I think one in particular from Madeira that with which it is aligned. So it got a couple of seats from that party as well. The socialists conceded the election on election night, realizing that they had no path to a majority. What is up for grabs now, or an open question now, is what the Democratic Alliance is going to do here about Chega. They need Chega's votes in the next parliament to form a government. Now they are unlikely to invite Chega into a coalition because its politics are so far right to be as to be noxious to the mainstream of Portuguese politics and to presumably most of Portuguese people. So they're unlikely to just invite them into the coalition and give them a role in the government, but they might approach Chega for support for, let's say, a minority cabinet where Chega would vote to confirm it and maybe lend support legislatively, but wouldn't have a direct role in the coalition. But so far, the Democratic Alliance hasn't even suggested it would be willing to negotiate for that level of support. So it could be a very interesting post-election period here, because it's going to be difficult for either one of or for the Democratic Alliance to chart a path forward here that doesn't involve some appeal to the far right. But I think there's definitely resistance to that.
Let's talk about Haiti. Ariel Henry has resigned and the country has been riven with chaos. So Derek, could you explain what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this, I think, last week. Ariel Henry was stuck in Puerto Rico. There's been an uprising of essentially criminal gangs, although I think at this point you could start to call them insurgents or rebels or the like. In Port-au-Prince, they've taken control. I mean, they already had control of much of the city, but they've attacked a number of institutions, the airport, the main seaport, the presidential or the sort of government offices. They've really, asserted control over Port-au-Prince. And Ariel Henry has been out of the country. He was out of the country in Kenya, trying to negotiate a deal to bring Kenyan police officers to Haiti as part of a bigger international effort to deal with the gangs. And the gangs struck while he was out. They launched this kind of combined joint offensive. And Henri has been unable to get back into Haiti. So he's been stuck in Puerto Rico. On Monday, late Monday, after a meeting of the Caribbean Community or CARICOM block, and under pressure from that block and from the U.S. Government, Henri announced that he's prepared to resign. He's waiting until some kind of political formation is created to take over executive functions from him on an interim basis. There's been talk of doing some kind of a presidential transitional council that would, assume kind of executive authority and then appoint a government with a new interim prime minister, et cetera, with an eye toward holding new elections. Haiti doesn't have any elected leadership right now. Henri was unelected. He wasn't even really approved by parliament. His legitimacy in that regard has been questionable at best this entire time. There's been, from what I can tell, in the couple of days since Henri announced his resignation, there's been a lot of back and forth between what the Caribbean community wants, the CARICOM block, which is this I think, 7-member presidential council that they're talking about appointing, and what actual Haitian political parties want. Several of them have rejected the idea of a presidential council. Everybody seems to have their own ideas about what kind of body could be formed here to take over authority from Henri. And so I don't really know where things stand at this point. They seem to be in limbo. There's the U.S. and CARICOM have one idea about a transition. I'm not sure it's very popular among actual Haitian politicians at this point. So I don't know where things are heading here. It's a very unsettled situation, to say the least.
Now let's end with some great news, and that is the United States has expanded its lead in terms of global arms. So, Derek,
update us. So the newest report from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, which looks at arms sales around the world, and covers, does them in 5-year chunks. So every new report is about the 5-year period leading up to when that report comes out. And their latest report was they released it on Sunday, found that the U.S. has increased its share of global arms sales to more than 40%. I think somewhere around 42% in this new report. The expansion, I mean, they were already the global leader, but they were in the sort of mid 30s, I think. So it's a significant increase. It comes mostly at the expense of Russia. Since the war in Ukraine, the Russian military is retooled to primarily focus on fighting the war. And also, I think, there's squeamishness about maybe purchasing Russian weapons these days. So their share of global arms sales fell by over half in this report, and they've now slipped behind France, which is another beneficiary, and has risen to second place. But really, I think the main focus here is that the U.S. is cornering the market on selling things to kill people, which is the thing that we do best. So congratulations to everybody involved.
Congratulations, everyone.
We're always so proud to be successful in these sorts of things.
All right, Derek. So have you heard that there was a 5-hour debate about Israel-Palestine with Norman Finkelstein, Benny Morris, Muin Rabbani, and Destiny, the streamer? Have you heard about this? I think we should do a debate recap in real time.
I heard about it, and I would have watched it, but I didn't want to, so I didn't.
I honestly cannot believe that this has happened. Someone just sent it to me.
I couldn't. I knew there was this like Finkelstein thing with this Destiny character who I don't know anything about. Just seems like a weird guy. But I didn't realize they had expanded it to include Benny Morris, and then that they spent five
hours.
Fucking hours. Like, how did anybody sit through that without drinking bleach? I don't know.
I have no idea. But
commend anybody who did that. That's like the baton.
I haven't seen it. I'd really rather do anything else than watch it, but I recommend it. If someone watches it, let me know.
Yeah, sure. Let us
know how it goes. And everyone, Prestige Heads, thank you for listening. Thank you for fighting on behalf of me, and we'll see you all soon. Bye.
Bye.